Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
It's Retail Focus, the last in October, and a special show for you because we talk a little bit of the pharmaceutical retail industry, we talk about paint retail, and we're going to talk about presidential costumes. That's right. But first of all, we're going to talk shoes, as Skechers reported their third quarter earnings after the closing bell last Thursday, and results were somewhat mixed, still lower than expectations across the board, resulting in a lot of negative media surrounding Skechers. But there's a lot of positives for Skechers, especially in brick and mortar and especially internationally.
Yeah, if you paid attention to a lot of the media headlines, it was somewhat doom and gloom for Skechers, but their third quarter earnings report did miss expectations a little bit on the earnings per share side of things. Earnings per share for the quarter came in at 42 cents versus analyst expectations of 46 cents. Revenue for the quarter was also down versus expectations, coming in at $942 million versus $954 million that was expected. That represented a 1.2% miss for the company. But as you mentioned, a lot of positives for Skechers that a lot of people didn't really touch on. If you look at the larger picture, revenue for the company came in 10.1% higher for their third quarter 2016 versus the third quarter 2015. They also had an 18.3% increase in international wholesale receipts. A lot of people don't really understand the whole business model of Skechers, but they have a lot of business with their wholesale international sales. So 18.3% increase actually was a very good factor, a primary factor contributing to their second highest sales quarter ever. So international wholesale was 40.1% of the total revenue that Skechers generated. So just a massive amount of business. Not only do they have a lot of retail stores, but a majority of their business is done through selling to third parties. 16% of the sales for the company were brought in by their retail locations, and same store sales came in at a positive 3.2%. So again, these are coming from all of the locations in total. So 3.2% is a very good number when you're looking at those same store sales. They also expanded the retail store count by 16%, which is really good news for those that are weary of their retail presence out there. They have 1,716 stores now in total, and this includes third-party locations.
And they appear to be positioned to be one of the businesses that can take advantage of the increased number of closures in malls and mall spaces as businesses either move away from malls or some of the businesses close down in malls. Very recently, Skechers, at least domestically, has been a mall-based or outdoor mall-based business, and so they might be able to take advantage of some of these slots opening up. You mentioned their increase in the number of brick-and-mortar stores they had over the last quarter, but also over the last 9 months. There's a lot more positives here, and I want to look at their margins. Gross margin this quarter was very healthy, came in at $430 million, and that's 45.6% of sales. That compares to the gross margin of last year's same quarter at $387 million, which came in at 45.2% of sales. So it's not only greater as a function of sales, but it's also greater overall because their sales increased and their selling expenses are decreasing for the most part. They also spent less on advertising this year, which may have hurt them because they mentioned that back to school sales during this last quarter were down from where they expected. So some of the negativity regarding Skechers in terms of where they missed on analyst expectations came in not only with back to school sales being down, but also the fact that they mentioned they are up against sluggish domestic retail sales like a lot of other retailers, which again, we're not sure that we see across the board, and domestic retail sales actually increased during September after a slight decrease in August, beating analyst expectations across the board in the United States. But they've mentioned, and I think this is more important, that other retailers have had to close down this year, some of which actually carry Skechers shoes. So it erodes their wholesale agreements, if not their own brick and mortar standing, because as we mentioned, they actually increased the number of stores. But one of the things that we talked about before the podcast kind of began recording and went to air, Leighton, is the fact that we're beginning to see a lot of blame put on macro level trends. And in some cases, the macro level trends aren't all the way there or aren't there to the extent that many analysts would have you believe. And it would be nice to see a company take internal accountability for missing on particular aspects. And this is something that Finish Line was able to do earlier this year. And they were actually able to tweak things internally and turn their same store sales around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, their focus right now isn't necessarily on the domestic sales for their brand, although they are making more forays into the retail expansion in the United States. I think the international business is something they've really been focused on. They talk about a South Korean partnership where they're going to expand their brand there and potentially open some third-party locations in that market. But overall, as you mentioned, they did blame a lot of the retail woes in the United States for their lackluster performance here with their retail stores. But if you look at their same store sales, I think they're really bolstered by that international presence. They have a lot of good brand equity abroad. And I think that they're maybe ignoring some of those darker spots in the United States. They do need to be accountable for those slumping sales in the United States. Typically, when you think of Skechers, you don't think of an elite brand. You think of something like Nike or even Under Armour coming up with their own shoe line. So I think Skechers really needs to invest a little bit more in these domestic problems. And if you look at their expenses, it's really evident as selling expenses decreased relatively. Third quarter selling expenses for Skechers came in at $67.8 million. It was an increase of $4.1 million. However, it was just 7.2% of sales compared to the same quarter last year where it was 7.4% of sales. So as you mentioned, they really cut back on some advertising in the United States this year. And that may have been to make this look good. They wanted selling expenses to be perhaps a lesser percentage of overall revenue. And they achieved that, however, with slumping sales in the United States because of all of those very competitive back-to-school promotions that other retailers had. So I think they could definitely focus on a little bit more advertising for these special promotions as they had done in years prior. And I think maybe they're going to do that if you look forward to quarter four for them when you see all of these sales for Black Friday and the New Year's Eve sales that are going to be going on in the footwear industry.
I think the question here is how much do they care about domestic sales versus international sales? Such a big part of their business comes from international sales versus U.S. domestic sales. And it's created some volatility as far as analyst expectations. When you look at the last four quarters worth of analyst expectations, they have, in order, met analyst expectations almost exactly, exceeded them by 18%, missed by 5%, and missed by 8%. That's over the last four quarters. So even though you're looking at overall gains and overall their data is pretty good at Skechers, there is some volatility there, and it makes it very difficult for analysts to get an idea of Skechers' business going forward. And this is something that I found interesting in their quarterly release. They're unsure of their capital expenditure for the rest of 2016, despite being this late in the game. They're managing to complete its European distribution center automation system, and they're looking at perhaps an additional 15 to 20 retail store openings, not only domestically, but also abroad. So they think it'll be somewhere in the $5 to $10 million range, but that's a pretty large range for this point in 2016, and it leads to some of that volatility as far as whether or not they meet analyst expectations in any given quarter. But again, analyst expectations are something that really only pertains to stock price, whether they go up or down based on whether or not they meet analyst expectations. They've shown in the past that kind of expecting anything out of Skechers one way or another can be somewhat of a fool's errand. They also released a somewhat negative outlook. They see net sales for the fourth quarter of $710 million to $740 million, and that's much lower than what was estimated prior to that point at $800 million. This would represent another analyst miss, this time around 9% once we get quarterly data for the fourth quarter. This is much deeper of a miss compared with this quarter where analysts were fairly close. They were within 1.2%. So the question, as we often ask sometimes in the fashion industry and in an industry where maybe a company missed on quarterly earnings in one quarter, are they sandbagging going into the fourth quarter, or do they really believe that their sales for the fourth quarter will be this tepid?
Yeah, and I think that they may be sandbagging just a little bit, but if you look at the response from investors and through the stock price, you can see that there was a 17% drop after they announced third quarter earnings. So perhaps they are taking this to heart. They're looking at these numbers and saying, well, maybe the business is slowing, not only domestically, but perhaps internationally. You saw the stock price fall from around $23 a share, and it dropped to about $18.90 per share, but it has since rebounded. As of recording this podcast, the stock is trading around $20 a share. But if you look at the 52-week trailing period, the stock is down 38%. So a lot of people are hoping to see positive things in the quarters to come because the stock has really been hampered as of late. As for the company overall, they do have a $3.1 billion market cap, and they don't have that healthy of a price-to-earnings ratio at 11.3. So overall, the company has a lot to work on here and a lot of communication with their investors and analysts as to their strategy going forward and if they're going to be paying attention more to those struggling markets that they are in.
And this is something that we really don't pay enough attention to necessarily on the Retail Focus podcast, but this type of thing that we're talking about adjusting potential earnings and adjusting expectations and looking at their stock price and trying to deliver value for investors, that's something you don't necessarily have with a privately held company. So here Skechers is caught up in this morass of what happens when you're a publicly traded company. Again, they do have an international presence. They have wholesale operations in over 160 countries. So they are an international brand. But again, tinkering with their overall outlook for the fourth quarter, which is something that obviously you wouldn't see a privately owned company have to worry about.
We move on to the pharmacy industry, where Walgreens and Rite Aid have officially pushed back their proposed $9.4 billion merger in hopes that they actually find a buyer for between 500 and 1,000 stores. They look to divest locations in hopes to get FTC approval in early 2017. So not only that, but Walgreens also posted their fourth quarter fiscal 2016 earnings last Thursday before the opening bell. Originally, they wanted the deal with Rite Aid to close by the end of 2016. So again, it's now expected to be at the beginning of 2017. They didn't give an exact timeline. They didn't say spring or summer. They just said near the beginning of 2017. So both pharmacy operators are looking to give up, again, between 500 and 1,000 locations. Originally, it was just going to be Walgreens giving up locations, and there were several rumors about that maybe it was just going to be 300 to 400. Then we heard about 800 locations will have to be given up. And then now it appears that both locations, if this merger were to happen, will have to give up locations in order to get that FTC approval. However, the big struggle has been finding a buyer for these locations. There's been a lot of private equity firms that have been rumored to have interest in acquiring some of these divested locations. And then also Kroger. And there was a really interesting article by Supermarket News that talked about the Kroger optionality here. Would they really be interested in getting into this space with a smaller type of format store? Or would they just be interested in maybe acquiring the pharmacy customers that Walgreens has had previously and that Rite Aid has had? So a lot of interesting questions surrounding the Walgreens-Rite Aid merger. And this has been something that we've been talking about for quite some time, but it just seems as though Walgreens is really intent on seeing this through.
And you just mentioned something that is totally unique to this space. We mentioned it months ago when we were talking about this merger, but it comes down sometimes to customers. Some of these companies and the private equity firms may just want to acquire the customers and reroute the customers from these locations that may have to close or be sold off in some way, shape, or form. And that's something that's unique to the pharmacy industry. In years past, you've seen Walgreens, Rite Aid, CVS, Kroger, all of these companies actually pay private pharmacy firms or smaller pharmacy firms for their customer list when one closes. So not unique to this deal here. Some analysts make a very good point in that Kroger's expansion in the past, not only have they grown through acquisitions, but they look more for turnkey operations where they can come in, take over, they don't have to rebuild, they don't have to completely overhaul the system, and that's what they might be getting with some of these Rite Aid and Walgreens locations. Now, the other aspect of of this, as we had speculated upon a few weeks ago, is that a lot of these locations that Rite Aid and Walgreens would be seeking to give up may be underperforming locations, which don't necessarily fit the bill of what Kroger wants to acquire. When we look at some of the regional brands that Kroger has acquired over the last few years, they've been successful regional brands. So Kroger may only have an interest in acquiring these outlets or these locations if they have a penchant for being successful. They're not going to take the bottom 5% of locations, let's say, from Walgreens, because the deal would not make sense to a Kroger. Back in July, for a little bit of perspective about Kroger's retail pharmacy business, Kroger announced that it acquired Modern HC Holdings, and they actually merged it with their Axiom Pharmacy business to create a specialty pharmacy that operates as a wholly owned subsidiary. So they do have a little bit of experience in the pharmacy retail industry. And of course, many of their stores, if not most of their stores, already have pharmacies built into the store. So they have some experience, but really the question comes with store footprint. How much would a footprint like this really help Kroger in the long term? But given the background with Kroger expanding through acquisition, this seems like a deal they might be very interested in. But then you go back to Walgreens and Rite Aid. If they're both looking now to give up 500 to 1,000 locations, which again, far more than what had been rumored even a month ago that both companies were looking to give up. Do you risk giving up all of those to a single third party, whether it be a Kroger or whether it be a private equity firm? You create a mini giant there, because even after this deal and even after the sell-offs, Walgreens would end up having around 11,000 to 12,000 locations between Walgreens and Rite Aid locations. That compares to 9,600 that CVS currently has. But if both stores sell off 500 to 1,000, that creates a third competitor in the marketplace, which would be good from the FTC's point of view, but maybe that would hurt Walgreens and CVS in the long term, especially if they sell off to an established retailer with a successful track record like Kroger.
And that's just it, in that Kroger has a very successful track record in the larger grocery retail space, but they don't have too much experience operating smaller footprint locations. So I think that's going to be something that if Kroger were interested, they're going to look at very carefully. So there's a few things here that I wrote down that I wanted to talk about. And one is the fact that Kroger may be able to get these 500 to 1,000 locations at a very steep discount. We talk about it's almost at the point of desperation for Walgreens. They want to see this through. Very much so. And so does Rite Aid. It's indicative in their share prices. Every time there's a news headline about a deal potentially going through or not going through, the stock price gets moved a lot. And so I think they really want this deal to go through. And I think Kroger may be able to take advantage of it, especially if they were to acquire all of the locations. Typically, you're going to be paying a less per unit price if you're taking the whole lot of locations. However, as you mentioned, this may be the bottom of the barrel for these Rite Aid and Walgreens locations. I highly doubt that Rite Aid and Walgreens are going to be giving up their highest performing locations to an operator such as Kroger or even a private equity firm. They want to keep these better locations in their portfolio for the long term. So you got to wonder, how is the quality of these locations? Are these in areas where Kroger will be able to hold on to these customers for a long term and even invest more money down the line? The other thing here is that Kroger really does have some longer term experience operating pharmacies, but as you mentioned, these are smaller footprint stores, and operating this many locations is kind of a different ballgame, especially when you're seeing that about 65% or 70% of top line revenue is coming from the pharmacy operations. Typically, this percentage is much lower in their grocery stores. You see pharmacy sales coming in much lower than 65%. They're focused more on the grocery and produce sales in their larger stores. So overall, there's a lot to really talk about here. And the other thing, the last point I wanted to mention is Kroger really doesn't have a lot of cash on the balance sheet right now, because they have been acquiring all of these turnkey locations, these regional supermarket chains that have a lot of brand loyalty behind them. They aren't positioned well right now to acquire another mass amount of locations. Granted, these are smaller locations and they may be able to receive this said discount on this total amount of locations, but it's just something that I'm sure they have to mull over, and they're probably just waiting it out, which is the smartest thing to do, because I just don't think there's going to be that many potential bidders for these locations. And I think that's been proven out over the last 6 months or so, in that Walgreens is trying to throw everything they can out to see what sticks.
And I think you're absolutely correct in that Kroger or even a private equity firm is correct to wait until there's this air of desperation surrounding the Walgreens Rite Aid deal, because you're already facing some hostility from a FTC that is a little bit anti-merger or anti-buyout. Let's talk about something we don't address very often with either Walgreens or Rite Aid anymore. It seems like we're always just talking about the merger and whether or not it's going to go through. But Walgreens did release their quarterly earnings and reported a diluted earnings per share of $1.07 on net sales of $28.6 billion for the quarter. Now, to put it in perspective, in the same period a year ago, Walgreens reported earnings per share of just 88 cents on revenue of about the same, $28.52 billion. So they've become more efficient in their operations. They represented an 8% beat on profit based on analyst expectations, but did experience a 1.8% miss on revenue, even though their revenue was up year over year. But this is the key here. You look at front of store sales, as they're sometimes called in the pharmacy retail industry, and same store sales, even though they saw a 3.2% rise for Walgreens, they saw a 5% increase in pharmacy same store sales. And just some back of the napkin math, in addition to what they actually said in their quarterly release, will tell you that the front of store sales suffered a little bit. In fact, pharmacy sales were up to 69% of total income. When you look at Rite Aid, they're a few percentage points lower than that, with pharmacy sales over the last couple of years representing anywhere between 65 and 67% of their total income. Walgreens has long said that they've wanted to boost those front of store sales, the sales in the grocery areas, in cosmetics, greeting cards, HBA, that type of thing, and they just haven't been able to do that over the last several quarters. Pharmacy sales are really what's keeping the ledger up for Walgreens at this point. And that's where I wanted to cycle around to talking about Kroger once again, because Kroger is a store that we know executes very well operationally in the grocery industry. So if they were to take over these similar footprint stores, one would think that just the brand recognition behind Kroger would certainly benefit them in running these smaller footprint stores, at least in terms of making sure they get their share of front of store sales in comparison to a company like Walgreens, CVS, or Rite Aid, who are kind of stuck in the high 60s in that regard as far as pharmacy sales are concerned.
Yeah, and if you look at why the FTC would not like to approve the Rite Aid-Walgreens merger, it is because of the pricing power they would have over the pharmacy side of sales. So if you look at what's lagging here, the front-end sales, you look at sales from cosmetics and groceries, this is something that Kroger really has pricing power over, and so they would actually be able to compete well with Rite Aid and Walgreens on this front, as you mentioned. So this is an interesting dynamic in that you have one company that can really leverage their pricing power and their buying power through the pharmacy side of things, and then Kroger can come in and compete with the rest of the store and the pharmacy side of things. So really, when we talk about it like this, it wouldn't necessarily be a bad acquisition for Kroger, and as you kind of alluded to, it would be a potentially aggressive competitor for Walgreens down the line. I want to talk a little bit about these earnings that Walgreens posted. They did post full-year guidance for earnings per share, coming in with guidance between $4.85 a share to $5.20 per share, and a potential contribution of 5 cents to 12 cents from the pending acquisition of Rite Aid based on expected store divesting. So they have overall a lot of things that they are unsure about. They don't know how many locations they're going to divest, if the deal will even go through. So the outlook here is a little bit murky, and I'm surprised they were able to even get a range within that close of a margin. So a lot of unknowns for 2017 if you're Walgreens, but it didn't really reflect that much in the stock price. The stock price actually popped 4% to around $80 a share share, and this was up from $77 a share. And Walgreens stock actually continued to gain momentum this week, now currently trading around $83 a share. So shareholders are pleased, and they must feel as though this merger and acquisition are going to go through with Rite Aid. The stock for Rite Aid is actually up a little bit as well. It's trading around $7.20 a share. This up from $6.66 per share. It's so dependent on what Walgreens reports that it literally trended with Walgreens over this past week. So news of the pushback was actually a positive sign for both Walgreens and Rite Aid in that it was signifying that the deal was going to happen. Even though it's not going to happen and get approved by the end of this year, people were given optimism that it was going to happen sometime in 2017, which is better overall than negative news.
Let's talk about a retailer we don't discuss often now on the Retail Focus podcast as our last news story of the first segment of the show. And we go to paint manufacturer, distributor, and retailer Sherwin-Williams. They reported their third quarter fiscal 2016 earnings before the markets open on Tuesday, and results came in mostly negative. And the stock bounced with it, downward of 10% during midday trading on Tuesday. Earnings missed analysts' expectations of $4.33 per share, coming in at $4.23 per share. But when you look at a retailer like Sherwin-Williams, they have so many facets to their business. They're very similar to Skechers in that you've got the wholesale business to look at, you've got the manufacturing part of their business to look at, a lot of different things to analyze and look at here for Sherwin-Williams.
Yeah, there is a lot to analyze. They're a distributor and manufacturer of paints around the world. So they have a massive operation with distribution and a massive operation with retail stores, not only domestically, but internationally. The retail store segment is something I wanted to focus on. And before we go any further, we should say that Sherwin-Williams has the paint stores group, the consumer group, which manufactures to third-party groups, the Global Finishes Group, which is for paints on marine and auto and refinish products, and the Latin America Coatings Group for agricultural purposes in North and South American markets. So they've broken their earnings up into four different segments. And if you look at their retail stores, something I wanted to focus on here and something that obviously we were intending to focus on for the Retail Focus podcast, they performed very well, coming in with the majority of the company's revenue at $2.23 billion. Again, overall revenue for the company for the quarter was $3.28 billion. This represented, the retail segment represented 68% of total revenue. So this is something that the company has been focused on, again, both domestically and internationally, as they have a presence in a multitude of markets. But revenue from stores were up 6.7% overall. Same store sales were up 2.1%. So you can see from these numbers, 6.7% represented the fact that they are growing their overall store count. Increased 7.5% to $5.95 billion for the nine-month period. So the three quarters for 2016, revenue was up 7.5%. If you compare that to this last quarter at 6.7%, you can see that they're lagging behind the overall average, but performance of these stores is up overall. Same store sales were up 5.2% for this nine-month period, in fact. So just massive numbers for Sherwin-Williams, and I'm sure they are pleased with these numbers overall. Profit from the paint stores group increased 10% to $518.3 million. Again, that profit is on revenue of over $2 billion. So just a highly profitable segment for their company, and I'm sure this is why they list this organization first of the four segments.
It is amazing because a lot of the news surrounding Sherwin-Williams was negative, but when you look at some of the facets behind the numbers for Sherwin-Williams, you certainly see a lot of promise. And again, this isn't a store that we talk about a whole lot, but when you look at the number of stores that they've opened in the last nine calendar months, you see that they've opened over 50 stores. So they are growing their total number of stores, as you alluded to, with overall top line revenue from stores jumping up 6.7%, despite same store sales increasing 2.1%. But their same store sales have been strong in all three quarters they've released so far this year. They've increased 5.2% in the last 9 months over last year's comp periods. So positive directions for Sherwin-Williams, and that's why they're increasing their investment in brick and mortar. Part of the reason Sherwin-Williams has been able to have success in their brick and mortar retail is because of their overall mix of customers. Back in 1980, you saw about a 60-40 mix. 60% of their customers were do-it-yourself customers, and 40% of their customers were contractors. However, in this last year, in 2015, and that's continued on into 2016, you're seeing it flip, where 60% of their business is contractor-based and 40% of their business is do-it-yourself-based. And the reason this is important for an industry like the home improvement industry, or like in this case, the coatings or paint industry, is that contractor sales, those are recurring sales. Contractors will always have business, whereas in theory, your do-it-yourself customers only have a finite number of things that they can paint. The growth of contractors over do-it-yourself customers over the last 3 years, you've seen it jump by a couple of percentage points. That's certainly helped in same store sales, but they're growing in both categories. This last fiscal year, they grew their do-it-yourself customer base by about 4% and their contractor customer base by about 6%. And this is an industry, the U.S. coatings industry, that is seeing a massive increase. 2015 over 2014, you saw an overall 5.1% increase, and that's across the board. That's not only Sherwin-Williams. So they are in a very high activity segment here in terms of the U.S. coatings industry, which is still bouncing back from the recession in 2008 and 2009. It's not yet back to the highs they saw in the early 2000s, but it's getting very close. And when you see year-over-year growth of about 5%, that's very promising going forward. As far as their retail stores, they are far more concerned with architectural paint in their retail stores than special purpose coatings, or what they call OEM coatings, which are often used in the automotive industry. And in fact, in the coatings industry, architectural paint makes up a little less than half of the overall piece of the puzzle there. In addition, Sherwin-Williams, and this is something that wasn't really mentioned too much in their quarterly results, but they, of course, had that deal earlier this year where they acquired Valspar. Valspar was the sixth largest paint company domestically in the United States. Sherwin-Williams was ranked in the top three. So that is a massive combination here between Sherwin-Williams and Valspar. And they're looking at synergies of about $280 million that they anticipate to achieve by 2018. So a lot of positivity going forward. Even if they miss somewhat on analyst expectations, you see the future of Sherwin-Williams likely in the positive.
Absolutely. And it, just if you look to the fourth quarter expectations, they expect to see same store sales from these retail operations increase in the low single digit realm, same as they have been for this last couple quarters. So overall, their expectations for the future look good, the immediate future at least. And as you mentioned, just a lot of opportunities here, and especially with this Valspar acquisition. This acquisition hasn't been finalized yet, but if you look at Valspar and their brand equity, people think of a quality paint, they're going to think of Valspar, and Valspar sold in a multitude of locations. You think of Lowe's and Home Depot and those kinds of things. So they're going to be able to leverage that brand and really receive not only those customers, but receive a lot more licensing opportunities down the line. You talk about store growth too. They opened 55 new locations in this last quarter. Overall, if you compare this amount of locations they have now at 4,100 paint stores globally, you compare that to 2012 numbers where they celebrated their 3,500th store opening. That's 600 locations in 6 years. Obviously, if you do that quick math, that's 100 locations per year they're going to grow, and they don't mention any slowing in that realm. And with those international same-store sales increases, I see a lot of positive signs for Sherwin-Williams. Since they are a publicly traded company, you see the reaction in the stock price from some of the negative news from this report. The stock was down over 10%. Falling to around $253 a share. This was actually a drop from $278 a share is what it was trading at before the earnings call Monday. So overall a bad sign if you're looking at the share price, but they have a lot of opportunities here. Again, the Valspar acquisition hasn't closed yet, and they have a lot of growth prospects internationally and a lot of licensing operations that are going very well for the company. You look at their stock on a one-year timeline, the stock was actually trading a little less than it is now. It's trading currently around $250 a share. This time last year, it was around $241 a share. But this, again, doesn't tell the whole story for Sherwin-Williams. It is a massive company with a $22 billion market cap and a price-to-earnings ratio, a healthy 21. So really a lot of optimism in the stock despite this last earnings miss and this 10% reduction in share price. I am curious to see how Sherwin-Williams reacts going forward in the fourth quarter and to see those results. Sherwin-Williams isn't a company we talk about often, and Sherwin-Williams is definitely in a particular segment that doesn't get a lot of attention from the mainstream media outlets, but they do, again, have a massive retail presence, and they are going to be trying to take market share from those larger retailers and operators such as Home Depot and Lowe's down the line. It looks as though they're positioned enough to do so. Their CEO had said that their balance sheet remains flexible and positioned well enough for the Valspar acquisition, and actually it alluded to having freed up cash for other potential things down the line.
And you might ask, going back to their buyout of Valspar, why we're relatively certain that that will go through when you're seeing such a negative climate in regards to buyouts, mergers, that type of thing. Even if you combine Sherwin-Williams and Valspar together, they make up less than 15% of the industry market share. So even a fairly critical FTC would likely go forward and approve this merger. But to put in perspective just how big Sherwin-Williams is in the U.S. paint market, if you look just at last fiscal year's sales, Sherwin-Williams took up about $11.3 billion of the market. Benjamin Moore, which is often thought of as their biggest retail competitor in the United States outside of those larger companies like you mentioned, Home Depot, Lowe's, even your True Values of the world, Benjamin Moore only takes up $0.8 billion of the industry. So significant. Smaller than Sherwin-Williams. And again, a lot to like from Sherwin-Williams' overall profile, even if they're not talked about all that much.
Well, if you're a listener to our other podcast, the Food Focus Podcast, we discussed how candy sales increased dramatically during the last 3 months of the year. We all know that there's a lot of holidays going on, especially Halloween, that drive candy sales in the larger market. So there was a report out this week from the National Retail Federation's annual survey conducted by Prosper Insights and Analytics that said that Halloween spending is expected to reach an all-time high this year, in part due to candy sales. However, $8.4 billion is the expected total spending for this Halloween season. And this includes not only candy, but costumes. And they're saying that a large part of this may be in part due to the presidential election. Yes, that's right. The presidential election, due to sales of masks and costumes from the leading candidates. We don't talk about politics a lot on this podcast, but this does seem to take precedent here, and that reaching an all-time high of $8.4 billion in sales means something to the industry. And if you look at last year's spending, it was $6.9 billion. So this represents a 21% increase year over year in Halloween sales.
And as is typical for this podcast, we do add the caveat that the NRF tends to be on the higher end of their estimates overall year to year. But when you look at the numbers, and you mentioned the election, political costumes or costumes of political figures are expected to be the third most popular costumes for adults over the age of 35. If you're wondering what the first two are, actually witches and pirates. So interesting statistic there, but they are very popular costumes. And given all of the press that's been given to the political cycle here and to the election cycle, that's not altogether unsurprising. And one of the interesting things that's actually pushed up Halloween sales is the introduction of memes, is the introduction of trends as well. So there are a lot of Halloween sales and a lot of Halloween costumes that are geared towards gorillas because of the Harambe incident that took place earlier this year that kind of grew legs on social media especially. So an interesting case here with seasonality. And one of the other aspects of it is when you're looking at Halloween sales, you're not just looking at your traditional retailers, your Walmarts, your Targets, your department stores, or your discount stores. You're also looking at the pop-up stores, much like we talked to Jason Marietta of Jake's Fireworks about earlier on in the year about seasonality and retail and setting up tents and that type of thing for fireworks. You have the same type of dynamics with Halloween costumes. And one of the things that plays into the hand of companies like Halloween Express, which set up oftentimes franchised locations in retail stores that have gone out of business, is now there is actually a surfeit of locations out there that are the perfect size square footage that they usually take in. Remember, they don't oftentimes rent in high rent locations. They just seek to temporarily rent informally closed retail stores. And it just so happens that Sports Authority, one of the largest sporting goods retailers in the U.S., has vacated a lot of their stores to this point. So you're seeing Halloween Expresses pop up in those particular stores. Halloween Express also looks to have their best year in quite some time, according to their website and according to their franchisee page. And that's just one of the companies that sets up nationwide in some of these empty retail spaces. It's really just a case of making a retail space work on a temporary basis for what they are trying to sell. And we mentioned Jake's Fireworks actually for 4th of July. They actually set up Halloween stores in a number of their brick and mortar locations as well. Layton, one of the interesting things when we were discussing and going back and forth about this topic before the podcast is how Halloween compares to the 4th of July on discretionary spending. And it seems like this year, Halloween certainly making some inroads on the 4th of July.
If you just look at the amount of Americans that celebrate Halloween, it's 171 people that are projected to take part in some sort of Halloween festivity this year. And that's an 11.7% increase year over year. But if you do compare that to the 4th of July for 2016, 214 million people celebrated it. So that represents about 45 million more people celebrating the 4th of July. However, you look at the total spending, an estimated $6.8 billion came in from 4th of July spending. If you compare that to the projected NRF spending of $8.4 billion, that is actually surprising to me because you think of 4th of July as a patriotic holiday. You have a lot of apparel that gets sold, a lot of hats, a lot of t-shirts, and things of that nature. But you just take into account everything else that does come in with Halloween. A lot of people love to decorate a little bit more so than they do for the 4th of July. So I found this very interesting. Despite 4th of July sales being up 1.4% from 2015, it looks as though Halloween spending on a national basis is going to exceed this year's 4th of July spending. Consumers will spend an average of $71 per household on a typical 4th of July day, essentially unchanged from last year's $71 they spent. And if you compare that to this year, people are looking to spend around $83 for Halloween. That's just a massive amount. I myself don't dress up for Halloween or take part, and I don't eat candy, but I do pass candy out. So I spend maybe $15 to $20. But you mentioned something very interesting that we hadn't touched on really, and that's the seasonality of commercial properties. A lot of commercial property owners will really seize the moment and take advantage of companies trying to come in for a limited amount of time. Typically, commercial leases are anywhere between 3 and 25 years long, but these companies come in, such as Spirit Halloween, requesting just 2 or 3 month leases. But oftentimes, companies will acquiesce and break off special deals for these companies because they are very temporary. There's not an expectation that they're going to be there a little longer than projected. They're going to be there for a set amount of time, and they have a built-in track record from other commercial property owners over the long term that they do, in fact, hold up their end of the bargain. So they're able to really strike on some lower rent deals, these companies are. And if you look at Spirit Halloween's projected revenue, they are owned by Spencer's, which is a privately held company. They brought in approximately $250 million last year in annual revenue from Halloween sales. So that's just a massive amount of money. And I'm sure that commercial property owners would love to take part in that and taking a little bit of money while the property's not really having any money being brought in during the last couple of months of the year. So a substantial piece in the merchandising market share overall are these Halloween shops that pop up during the last 3 months of the year. And I am curious to see if this $8.4 billion amount of revenue does come to fruition for 2016, or if it's just all talk. But I would say that the political elections happening right now are going to have a really big piece in this particular market, especially if you look at the social media presence. A lot of people are going to be getting specific costumes and showing them off on social media, therefore driving the sales through the month of October and November.
I want to mention something else with social media, though, because recently, over the last 3-4 years, we've seen retailers come under fire for selling perhaps controversial costumes or what are deemed as offensive costumes. And even Walmart has been in the news. They, just a couple of weeks ago, had to pull a suicide scar / razor blade costume from their shelves because it made light of suicide or cutting oneself. But Walmart actually has a team in an area of their global e-commerce headquarters in San Bruno, California, where they actually pull some of the offensive costumes from their e-commerce site. Walmart's in-store costumes obviously have an opportunity to be vetted before they go out onto the floor, but many of their e-commerce connections, and you could say the same of Amazon, come through third parties. So it's the job of this team. It's actually something they came up with several years ago to try and vet out costumes that might be deemed offensive and might generate negative PR for the company on social media. So as much positive PR comes from getting some of these neat or interesting costumes and people posting it to Instagram, you have to worry about the negative PR about costumes that people find offensive in one form or another, and make sure that in the case of Walmart, a company that really tries to hone in on that family-friendly image, that they're not pushing any boundaries whatsoever. So it is a difficult time for their PR team. It is a difficult time for their trust and safety compliance team, whose job it is to vet these particular costumes. And it's become increasingly difficult now that the conversation has perked up around things like cultural appropriation, where in the 80s and 90s, oftentimes, those weren't topics of conversation in the halcyon days of e-commerce.
It is an interesting dynamic when you look at how Halloween is supposed to be slightly offensive and scary to some people, but not too offensive. So a lot of companies really have to draw a line there in what they deem is acceptable to selling to the general public and what's not. So this is going to be interesting going forward as to if there's going to be any more costumes that are going to be pulled off the shelves, because every company, every manufacturer of these items, especially costumes, are always trying to one-up another. So it is a business environment, it is competitive, and there is a bit of a shock factor that surrounds Halloween.
Well, we've reached our last news story here on the Retail Focus podcast, and for this, we go to outdoors and sporting goods retailer REI. For the second consecutive year, they said they have decided to put, and I quote, purpose before profit, and they will not be open for Black Friday, instead encouraging their customers to hashtag opt outside to try and get people to join the movement. Last year, this generated some concern among certain retailers that this would splinter Black Friday even further, and we've seen some of that because some of the sales have been moved up to Thanksgiving Day. But now that retailers are choosing to close on Thanksgiving Day, retailers are a little bit concerned that Black Friday might be splintered further by REI's decision to close and try to generate positive public relations out of their choice to give employees Black Friday off.
And they're really trying to spread this movement via social media with the hashtag #OptOutside, basically trying to get not only their employees, but their consumer base to go outside and spend time with their family and friends and any loved ones they may have instead of shopping for Black Friday. We all know Black Friday is a bit of a chaotic time. A lot of people waiting in lines, rushing to get their products that are on sale for that particular day. But REI really has a focus here in getting outside and living life, not really getting caught up in the moment with all the Black Friday shopping that's about. REI, for our listeners who don't know, they operate 149 retail stores in the United States. And as you said, Trent, they are a sporting goods retailer and they specialize in camping gear, travel equipment, and clothing. But they also offer services such as outdoor-oriented vacations and outdoor courses. So they have rock climbing courses that you can sign up for and the like. And right now, if you look at their opt outside hashtag for the Black Friday movement, they have almost 301,000 people signed up for this on their website. So this is a massive movement that's really taking hold. And they even have some popular sponsors that you may know, such as Subaru and the Outdoor Foundation. They really are trying to get their people, again, not just their employees, but people overall, to get outside and enjoy the time with their family and friends, as most employers do have the day off. If you're not in retail, typically, manufacturers will have the day off for employees, and it's typically paid time off as well. As related to that, they have 12,287 employees, they say, will all be paid for Black Friday. So this is quite interesting, as they are partnering with 200 nonprofit and for-profit organizations to encourage more of this happening around the United States. So really an interesting time. And as you kind of alluded to, I'm curious to see if this movement does spread on to other retailers. However, we should mention that REI is a consumer's co-op, so they're really given that flexibility and leverage in deciding these types of things. They can decide to take a Black Friday off because they're not publicly traded. It would be difficult for a larger retailer such as Walmart or a Target to decide to take off Black Friday simply because of a movement such as this. They would lose a lot of sales, sales that are some of the highest of the year for these particular retailers. And that's something that shareholders probably wouldn't like in the end.
This is actually a topic that I discussed off of the podcast air with Dr. Dennis Hoffman back in April. Now, longtime listeners of the podcast will recognize Dr. Hoffman as a person that was speaking about the dynamics of retailers being closed on Sundays. And he was talking about some of the blue laws that had been in place in the 70s, 80s, on into the 90s, where they started being rolled back in a number of towns. And blue laws, again, kind of dictate that retailers should be closed on Sundays, not perform any retail business on Sundays in certain areas. And one thing he said about this REI promotion last year is that it worked so well for their particular customer base. Because their customer base embraces this type of thing, embraces getting away from the holiday rush and the holiday shopping traffic and all of that, it works very well for REI, but the businesses have to be very cautious in how they approach promotions like this. As you mentioned, not only do you have the fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders to concern yourselves with, and you have your own bottom line, of course, to concern yourself with, you have to wonder how you're going to be perceived by the overall public. REI knows that its customers will appreciate this gesture, its employees will appreciate this gesture, and they know that a lot of their customers would typically go outside during a holiday day anyway. So they're not really introducing something new or something completely different. But what's interesting is that none of the other sporting goods retailers out there have jumped into opting out of these Black Friday promotions. So you look at companies like Dick's, Academy, Cabela's, Bass Pro Shops, Gander Mountain, all of them are still participating as of right now in the Black Friday movement. But you have begun to see, after REI announced this, smaller retail stores in towns like bicycle shops, for example, doing the same thing with Black Friday. And it will be interesting to see in the future whether or not this catches on. But at least in the short term, I think if anything, Black Friday has been splintered less this year simply because retailers have taken a stand and are remaining closed on Thanksgiving for the most part. There are certainly exceptions to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been talked about for quite some time through various media outlets that Black Friday sales may not even be that big this year. Even though some people are saying they are going to top last year's sales, there's been so many other sales in the e-commerce realm. You talk about Amazon's Prime Day and things of that nature. And then the anticipation for New Year sales as well might take away from that. So there is this sense that Black Friday may be a little bit more overlooked than previous years this year. And I wanted to talk about REI's infrastructure for this event. This opt-outside event has its own website, rei.com/opt-outside. outside. And on there, you can see different pictures of what their employees have done in previous years. For instance, they go on mountain biking tours, they go rock climbing, they go skiing and canoeing. So there's a multitude of activities they suggest for you to participate in. And they also have an area for which you can type in your zip code and search an activity for yourself, for your adjacent area. For instance, they have different parks designated. If you're in a specific zip code, they have dog-friendly parks, they have family-friendly activities, rock climbing. So a ton of things to just get people up and outside. And really, they built in this infrastructure. Instead of just saying, go outside instead of shopping, they said, no, here are some things that you can do instead of shopping. So they've given an avenue for their customers into trying things out for this hectic Black Friday promotional season.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we wrap up this week's Retail Focus podcast with a look forward at a couple of news stories that we're keeping our eye on over the next week or the next month. And I'll begin. In fact, I'm looking at a story that'll come out this week. O'Reilly Auto Parts will release their third quarter earnings on October 26th after the closing bell, and they'll actually go over them in a presentation for October 27th. They have put together a string of very impressive quarters. Most recently, their second quarter produced 4.3% same-store sales growth, and that was on top of the 7.2% same-store sales growth their stores produced in the second quarter of fiscal year 2015. So I'm looking at it to see if they can keep up the momentum. We've mentioned how in the past sometimes O'Reilly serves as a bellwether for auto parts retailers, but that hasn't been the case as much this year. Although AutoZone has remained fairly steady, Advanced Auto Parts has really taken some hits on their quarterly earnings. But I'm more interested to see if O'Reilly can continue this momentum and continue to work towards expansion of their brand on a nationwide basis in the auto parts retail industry. They increased a lot of benchmarks in the previous quarter, increased expectations for the third quarter, and I'd like to see if those things have been met.
O'Reilly's is one of those niche operators in the retail industry that you don't hear a lot about, but they operate very well. They're a highly profitable business despite their higher inventory levels. So this is a business that we have been keeping an eye on, and it's really something we do like to talk about on the Retail Focus. So I am curious to see those results when they come out. My story, Trent, is about Amazon. Yes, Amazon again, and we're going to be talking about the Amazon Fresh format for Amazon and how they've just announced they're expanding into Chicago and Dallas effective immediately. So this kind of came under the radar. We talked about Amazon Fresh and different formats rolling out along the West Coast over the past couple weeks, but this really takes back some analysts that were saying they're going to be taking it a little more slowly in these different markets, especially in the Midwest. You don't really think of Amazon expanding in these markets, but currently they have a presence in Boston, Baltimore, Northern Virginia, and as we mentioned, on the West Coast, a couple markets in California, and of course, their home, Seattle. So this is interesting to me, just a little bit of a refresher about Amazon Fresh. The service allows customers to order groceries from their online platform, and what this does is basically ensures that groceries will be delivered to their house at a fee of just $14.99 a month. And this is in addition to their Prime membership, which is either $10.99 a month, or if you want to do it annualized, it's $99. So I am curious to see how these markets react. We know that Texas is a market that Kroger really has expanded their ClickList program to good positive reviews. So people are enjoying the ease of this service, and bringing goods to their home should be an even better step for the consumers in this area. But again, this is just for Dallas and Chicago. I am curious with this to see where they expand from here, as it looks like they've been putting immense amounts of capital behind Amazon Fresh overall.
I'll be anxious to see the price points they roll out in those markets in Chicago and Dallas, and to see if they're a little bit more competitive than the price points, especially on produce, that they've been able to offer in other areas this program currently exists. That'll do it for the Retail Focus podcast this week. Be sure and check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast, where Layton updates all of the retail news that we get in during the week. Reminder to check out our Food Focus podcast that comes out every Friday afternoon. Until next week, for Layton, I'm Trent, and so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.